Welcome to the Performance Health Podcast. My name is Tim Caron. Today we're going to be talking about mesocycle design with Corey Hobbs. It's going to be a big step in the direction of culminating this entire season. We want to make sure that we're wrapping this up in a good bow, meaning that you have a start and the end all together. But the real work is the reps, the conscious effort to writing a really good program every single time. Hope this has been very helpful. If you like what you've been listening to, please like, subscribe, share. Makes a big difference, as well as head over to phpodcast.com. Get on all the blogs, get on all the other great resources we have over there. Promise you, you won't regret it. All right, let's talk about some mesocycle design.
Tim, season five continues. We talked variables last week, and now we're breaking into setting up our mesocycle. So what is a mesocycle?
Ooh, yeah, it's a block that we're going to keep a certain amount of exercises, sets, and reps, right? So tempo, intensity, all the variables. So the last two topics we talked about, exercises, right? That microcycle, we're going to get through a microcycle when we repeat that same workout again. And that combination with the protocols or methods that we're going to be doing with sets, reps, time under tension, intensity, rest, all that intersection. And then that progresses into another training block, which if we're thinking about it from this fractal, right, we look at a rep manifest out all the way to a macro cycle. Those are two ends of the continuum. And then we look at it from that individual training session to a micro cycle to a micro cycle to a mesocycle. And again, like simple rules repeats that if it's true on a repetition, it has to be somewhat connected to the larger, more aggregate portion. And I don't want to get super technical in math, but I think as we start to break down that fractals, it's about as close to a law without being a law as it could possibly be. Mm-hmm. And if we think about the connection to program design, that there has to have some sort of relationship between the point of a repetition within an exercise that plays out over a set, relatively speaking, to either that training session or beyond that, that microcycle, and then even further beyond that, that mesocycle. And if there's no synchronous nature of that, of those like variables or those exercises, I find it's going to lead to maybe some unpredictable outcomes. And just this very, very simplistic way of, hey, can we explain this to our clients and athletes with them feeling like this is intuitive and logic, should have some sort of thought process. And when we're breaking down, okay, well, here's our mesocycle. Here's how we're going to layer in our microcycles over a course of 2 to 8 weeks and how we're going to manage each one of those microcycles week over week, that should feel easy to explain. It should feel intuitive. Obviously, we don't need to use the traditional nomenclature that we're using within our peer-to-peer conversations, but that translating that information to our client of, hey, each week we're going to go up for 4 weeks. That doesn't seem that overly complicated to explain to our clients and athletes. And that immediately tells us a couple things. One, that we're planning to go 4 weeks with a certain list of exercises, sets, reps, tempo, rest, intensity, as well as the expectations that we're going to try to develop this over 4 weeks. So we need to either manage our training load from week one to week four, or we really need to be dotting our I's and crossing our T's each week in between our training sessions to accommodate that level of adaptation or that progressive overload within that mesocycle. But if we have no conversation around, well, how are you going to convey this to your client or athlete and how are they going to understand that? Then we're probably missing a really big opportunity of how effective can that mesocycle actually be and its relationship to that repetition, that microcycle, or that training session, and then be a microcycle and then ultimately the mesocycle.
So now as we set up our mesocycles, how do you break it down to progress from one meso to the next, just like you would in the microcycles? And we could even get into how do you do it gen pop and once you come in 3 days a week for the rest of your life versus mm-hmm. athletes where we used to have 4 years, maybe 5 years, but now it's like we got to play now. So we could get real deep into the weeds of mesocycle design.
Yeah. So I think we got to pick a horse here where I would look at it from what is going to be the style of microcycle that you're going to use in terms of the format. And why I used training split so early on in this whole series was that we should have some sort of idea how we're going to organize that microcycle, because that plays a big role in that mesocycle. And I do a conjugate or a mixed method where I'm trying to hit a relatively power-based thing or a relative strength or a functional hypertrophy or muscular endurance within each training session is some component of that. And that plays out over the course of 4 days. And I want to have to utilize a upper-lower split or a push-pull split. Then I got to look at that. Okay, now we're going to progress all of those qualities within a training session spread out over 4 days for X number of weeks. And if I look at my mesocycle, you know, we could break that up into 2, 4, 6, 8 weeks. Maybe something, you know, goes up high as 12 weeks before we change the workout. And if I do a mixed method, now I got to figure out a way to progressively overload all of those qualities with all those exercises simultaneously. And, you know, for the record, you know, the having a much broader approach or, you know, throwing grenade and hoping, you know, that becomes difficult to maintain the truth of your program. And one thing that's very quickly to understand is if I say progressive overload is the foundation of our program, but it feels like it's arbitrary in our C series, meaning that we're not really stressing the importance of going up each week when we get to these tertiary exercises, that it starts to erode the foundational principle of program design. And where I really think about in terms of mixed method and conjugate method, and I've said some pretty harsh things that I think it's for cowards. I think it's for people who don't really know what they want to do and just do everything. And say that's overly critical or that's a very strong term, especially with the level of success. But the truth to me comes down to, it's easy to talk in hypotheticals. It's really hard to get out there in front of someone and say, hey, progressive overload and progression are principles, so they have to be true, but not necessarily true when I get to the C series because it just doesn't matter as much. It's just arbitrary and it's like fluff. And, you know, the example I think a lot about with coaching is like these like fun days where you do like a recreational day, like play kickball instead of doing sprint work and Olympic lifts and heavy squatting and pulls. And, you know, that you get a question from the athletes, if I'm ever going to have a fun day, like it's called an off day. I won't bring you up here to do fun. Like it's just, you could probably figure out a way to have more fun without me. Like I can promise you that
all the time.
Yeah. I'm not as good at fun as you are. Trust me. So in that conversation though, gets into the, if I'm planning or programming in a fun or throw in day, you know, I think again, it erodes the foundational principle of every day has a purpose and a meaning. If it wasn't, then why would we schedule it? Mm-hmm. And one thing that I do generally like about block or a more targeted focus of a quality for an entire mesocycle is association. If we can't go up, we don't do it. And that whatever period of time I'm going to do from a 4 or 12 or 4 or 8 week or however, et cetera, that I need to be conscious of that if I can't go up week over week, that I probably shouldn't think about doing it. And I know people probably going, yeah, but progressive overload's hard in the group or progressive overload's hard in this. Then you got to get better, right? Because it's lazy and, to be completely frank, like doing a disservice to your clients and athletes if you're not programming in progressive overload and you don't have accountability and checks and balances to do that. And when you do a mixed method or you do a like very diversified approach within a training session or a microcycle and you have so many targets you're trying to hit simultaneously, it erodes the foundational principle of training. And then we have no real idea of the level of adaptation. Now, why I say it's for cowards is because I'm betting all of my chips on one singular number. I'm not hedging my bets. I'm shooting at one target and I'm betting on one big number. And if I win, I win big. If I lose, I lose big. I just don't think training, like you taking a very diluted, diversified approach to training, is doing as much as you possibly can be for your clients or athletes. They're paying you to zero in on what is necessary and then do that more than anyone else in the world. And because they can do a lot of different things simultaneously and try to put all their water and all their in multiple buckets simultaneously. But as we're starting to break that down, the real thing they fall down on and not really succeed with is the lack of progress with having so many different moving targets. And as a qualified strength conditioning professional, and we talked about this at the onset, either I'm running towards something or I'm running away from something, that I'm trying to develop weaknesses in the strengths, or I'm trying to figure out what the strength is they need when they need to peak, and then reverse engineering off of that. It's that simple understanding of the vector that you're going with training and that understanding what the relationship with all of the exercises and sets and reps and time and attention and intensity and rest in conjunction with those vectors that we're trying to go is what creates the outcome. And the only way you really know if you're moving in the right direction is whether you are going up in some way, shape, or form week over week. And it doesn't really matter what you're going up in, right? The truth is you can justify any means of progressive overload. You just need to have it, right? We can look at it from a volume perspective. I want to go up in reps or sets. We can look at it from an intensity perspective where either I'm trying to increase the intensity week over week. Maybe I'm trying to increase the amplitude or the speed in which I'm trying to go over week over week. Or the final aspect, which would be the density. I'm trying to do something more compressed, or I'm trying to do something more expanding, meaning that I'm going to do more work in the same period of time, or I'm going to try to do the same work in less time. But the truth is, when I'm looking at those things in relation to the program that I'm writing, it's easier to manage if I have a more focused target. When I have a very, very hedge bet approach, all that stuff becomes harder and harder to manage. And there could be an easily argument of, well, we're going to miss the mark on several other key factors. But at least I know what I got when I do it. If I'm good at layering or organizing my training, the training residual, therefore, from what I'm doing is going to lead over into the next one and successfully build up a higher ceiling, then I'm going to have a better approach. And I could shorten my mesos or I can lengthen them at any point I want, right? There's nothing saying that I have to do a 2 or 4 or 8 week program unless I have some sort of justifiable reason as to how much I want that training residual to manage or leap over to the next training block, or how little or more most time I need to spend in it. But when we're breaking down this conjugate mixed method approach, I generally think it's because I don't know what I want to do and I just want to do everything just to play it safe. And that's why I call it cowardice. I just don't necessarily think it takes a lot of heroism to write a program that has everything in it. Right? Imagine if I went to a financial analyst, I'm saying, hey, I want to really make a lot of money in the next 10 years. And he puts all of my money in every single stock, playing it safe, right? That some will go up, some will go down, but I'll be kind of net neutral, if not up like slightly. Like, I didn't say that. I said, I want to bet big. I want to put all my money on one stock and let it ride because I want to be a billionaire. You're not going to become a billionaire without taking some risk. I might be a thousandaire. And that's fine if that's kind of where I want to be and play conservative. But the truth of the matter, like when I'm looking at performance and I'm looking at training and I have a deficiency or direct need, that the difference between elite level training and kind of average stuff is it comes down to your willingness to really bet big. And I don't think it's a big bet, or I don't think it's a big actual risk when you have progressive overload giving you truth. And if you're not going up, gives you some information. If you are maybe lacking in performance, meaning you're hitting diminishing returns during a training session, gives you information. If you're progressing in the right way and it's having a residual or correspondence over to the things that matter in terms of running fast, jumping higher, or throwing a med ball further, great, all good. And when we're really breaking that down, we look at the length of a meso, it's how long I need that quality to really develop and what is the residual I'm looking to get from that, right? One of the other ones that is often forgotten is this idea of reversibility. That when we look at principles, that the foundation of the entire profession we are in is based off of someone convincing a coach or an administration we should train the football team in January for the September season. That was a very contraindicated and really far-fetched idea 30, 40 years ago. I would say 50, 60 years ago now. And that dynamic, as it played out, became the foundation of our entire profession. And the same thing applies again, practically in a reverse order of how much do I need to spend time and a certain quality to get a residual from it? And maybe I need 2 weeks. Great, move on. And we see this with muscular endurance quite a bit of like this GPP to SPP that I got to develop volume before I start to develop some sort of sport specific action, whether it's a rate of force development or an actual specific movement pattern that we're doing within the sport. And when you think about the muscular endurance on the way end of the spectrum, like January for a football team, that it serves a foundation of, hey, I want to have better fitness. I want to have better recovery. I want a better endocrine system. I want a better connective tissue and muscular size and density. Sure, that all has a platform. But what we see pretty quickly is a drop off in performance because it's either overly acidic. They don't really do a good job of removing CO2. Cut your losses, move on to the next training residual that has a bigger net impact, but it's still a necessary step to do. So maybe it goes 2 weeks. or maybe I have a really out of shape team. We did nothing for the month of December because we suck at football and we didn't play in a bowl game or any postseason. Guys are pretty out of shape. Maybe I need to spend 4 weeks. But again, it comes down to how long does that residual need to last is really, really in relation to how long we actually train that quality. That is reversibility at its foundation. It's a direct linear relationship to the time spent doing it. It's the time that actually goes into the rate of decay. And if that decay is needing to be slow, we need to spend more time with it. Now, on the other end, we can look at it from, hey, a training age perspective. If we look at a novice, everything is new and everything will work for a longer period of time because they have no relative start point. Versus an advanced, they have a better idea of what their upper rep max predicted lift would be. They have a more familiarity with motor pattern. They typically get burnt out quicker from a monotony standpoint. So we can have a continuum there too of novices need longer mesos and advanced level athletes need shorter mesos. We look at a muscle fiber type where we look at slow twitch athletes versus a fast twitch athlete. A fast twitch athlete typically is going to burn out quicker, which would garner, hey, we need to have shorter mesos. It leads into we need to have higher exercise rotations as well. The motor pattern gets burnt out quicker because they just simply exert more per rep, per set, per exercise on any given day. So having a change of stimulus of loading of that position where that mechanical tension is felt or where that motor pattern really stresses the CNS, that is going to have a big holistic impact by having more frequent exercise rotation. But then also from a CNS or physiological perspective, they're just burning more or utilizing more because they are more fast twitch and they go through size principles quicker versus a slow twitch athlete. They are mules. They just have better recovery rate intra and inter. So meaning during the set, they actually can go longer because they can buffer acidity faster. They utilize slower twitch muscle fibers more predominantly. They go through the size principle a little bit slower. So they're going to be able to get a longer duration from an individual set, but then that fractals out to, hey, they can recover faster between sets and they can recover faster between exercises and they recover faster between training sessions. So therefore we can go longer with a mesocycle because of that. But if we're really breaking this down, and I know this seems like a very elongated thing that I'm kind of going on potentially a tangent. It's this, the truth of the core of everything that we're talking about is unless you have a really central idea as to why you're doing what you're doing, everything is wrong. That if we have no clear plan as to what we're trying to accomplish with that singular rep, with that singular set, that exercise, that training session, that microcycle, and even that mesocycle, that we're never really going to get what we want. That everything from the smallest, most inconsequential detail to the larger, big aggregate thing matters. And if nothing matters, then move on to another profession. If everything matters, figure out a way to organize that and figure out a way to try to consolidate that down and being successful. And anyone who's worked in Gen Pop, anyone who's worked with athletes, anyone who's worked in any setting whatsoever, is if you can't convey it to your client, you might have a cult of personality and have this charisma and get away with it for a certain period of time, but it won't play out over a longer period of time. That you need a certain level of confidence with principles and foundation to translate into a program and the ability to execute it. And then it always scales out. It scales out from you from one session to the next over a longer period of time. So there's a time scalability component and it scales out from you to other people, either coaches that are working for you or coaches that represent your program in some way or clients that are doing your program somewhere, somehow. And going in this time or this person type of continuum, but either way, the ability to scale and all bad decisions based off of not really thinking it out will be revealed either on this time variant or this person variant. And everything is going to play out the way you don't want it to because of that. And when I look at it from, if I have a person that has never met me doing my program versus I have a person that is doing my program over a long period of time, will there still be a foundation of quality and execution based off a simple premise of can I go up every single week with technical proficiency, maintaining rep and set integrity? Great, it works out just fine. And block periodization is just quite frankly easier to do. And I'm sure there's people out there who will look, hey, I don't have a lot of time to train. I got to do a mixed method. Sure, I get it. We can always make that excuse. To be completely frank, we can make that excuse if I have a kid for 4 years. I can make that excuse if I have a kid for 8 years. But the end of the day comes down to the, is it really that easy to manage that over the course of one mesocycle to the next? Can I progressively overload it? Can I progress it? Does it have diminishing returns, reversibility, specificity, individuality? Yes or no? And if it doesn't, go back to the drawing board, rewrite your program.
You want to talk about everything matters. Like, you just listed 5 or 6 different qualities that could each result in different programs. So like one coach, a big group of athletes, you could really get deep into this. I wanted to dive deep into the idea of just focusing in on one quality. That doesn't mean the other stuff goes away, right? Or do I misunderstand that?
No, it doesn't. So there's always a bleed over effect, right? So imagine that I did a throw a rock in the water, and that creates a concentric circle. That rock that initially went into the water, that initial contact creates a residual, and it blossoms out into these waves that go all the way out. Did that, if like the classic story, if a tree fell in the woods and no one's there to hear it, does it actually make a sound? The answer is yes. To be completely honest, it makes a sound. Doesn't matter if whether you heard or not. If I do muscular endurance in January and I do nothing like that in July in preparation for a football season, did we not do muscular endurance then? And one of the things that I think is so critical when we look at block periodization is the organization and the layering from sequencing of, hey, accumulation and intensification. There should be a more gradual change of, let's say, 8 to 15% intensity. Meaning if I'm going to go from muscular endurance into power, that might be too big of a jump of intensity, right? I might be going from too slow and too long to too fast and too short, that I have to have some sort of gradual transition from one training block to the next. And what that does is increases the residuals time, right? That now I'm slowly teasing away from that initial quality that I'm training, and it preserves it longer, going back to the principle of reversibility, that the longer I spend and the more that actually ties into something. And for the record, you know, these adaptations, they don't decay if we're training as much as we might think they would, mm-hmm. right? Meaning that if I'm doing hypertrophy after I'm doing muscular endurance, I'm working more oxidative work in our first training block, and then I go to a very acidic training block with a lot of metabolic stress, I don't throw everything I had in that muscular endurance oxidative block out the window. Now, will I express more CO2? Will I produce more lactate? Will I go through more glycolytic pathways? Absolutely. But the mitochondrial density that I created, the buffering capacity within those type 1 muscle fibers is increased. The CO2 removal is improved based off my cardiorespiratory function. My oxygen delivery is improved based off of stroke volume and cardiac output going up. That residual lasts a lot longer when I do a quality that may be not as related to it, because it enhances that future quality. And it might be a 2-week laggard effect. I'm going to go through fitness fatigue of this 3-to-1 fitness to fatigue ratio, that if I'm within that window, meaning that fatigue isn't greater than 1, relatively speaking, to the adaptation I get of 3 for fitness, then I can have this beautiful residual and layering effect from that initial rock I threw into the water. And that rock landed there, and now the ripples get bigger and bigger and have some momentum going in that direction, that now I have a full-on tidal wave going into where I want to be, and we cause mass destruction into our opponent's hearts.
And how do we factor in, like, let's say group size? Like, it's me and 50 athletes. Maybe some are more novice. Maybe I got some who've been training with me 3 or 4 years, might need a little bit different. How do we balance that in and give them all what they need through a mesocycle?
You want to program to the lowest common denominator in a group, right? So will that person in that group that is the dumbest and least capable be able to understand and execute on what you're asking them to do, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're looking at that worst in the room, and this is the law of averages, that you always have to accommodate one aspect of that denominator, meaning that, like, hey, I'm going programming top down or bottom up and hopefully hitting as much positive aspect. But we have to look at what are going to be the bigger constraints to that program of that, maybe that cancerous effect of someone who's really incapable or out of their depth doing a program they cannot react or respond well to. Or we can look at potentially the positive effect or the domino effect from that person who's really good pulling everyone with them. Chances are the person who's really good is probably focused on themselves, and the person that's really bad is probably trying not to be noticed. And you think about that from if I'm explaining our program and it's based off of principles of training, and that person who's the dumbest, least capable in the room understands that we're going to go up each week for 4 weeks, you have a better chance of being successful than not. And I know that might seem like, oh, wow, you don't really get it because you don't work with elite level populations. Okay, well, I'll tell you this. The luxury of working with one person where you can pivot if it's not working is not something that people who work in the team environment get to enjoy.
Yep.
And that truth of the matter, when you really break it down, I'm like, I write this very, very high level program with a lot of variation, a lot of nuance, and it's really trying to address the best in the room. And then you see that completely incapable out of his depth or out of her depth, like response to this, you're going to find in that, hey, this is going to be a very problematic program to manage because you're going to have to spend an inordinate amount of time with that person who's least capable to get them through. And then you're going to avoid and neglect the person that does have some sort of semblance of what's going on. So talk to the dumbest, least capable person in the room and make sure they understand. And then the other end, find encouraging ways from rack assignments or doing ways to toggle up the intensity, the volume, the time under tension, creating a little bit more nuance for that person. It could be exercise selection as well, right? We could have rack 10 doing goblet squats, rack 1 doing heels elevated front squat. You know, all that stuff has a big component in how you manage and operate those rooms, but they're still doing maybe the same exercise, so it has a higher or lower governor, right? The goblet squat having a higher governor and the heels elevated front squat having a lower governor. And you're both doing 5x5 with an intensity. So the 4 weeks from now is going to be the heaviest set of five we'll do. Reverse engineer it, try to subtract 5 pounds to this week. So this means that this week we're going to do 20 pounds less than we're going to do 4 weeks from now. So if you're doing goblet squat, you're going to do a 70-pound dumbbell or a 90-pound dumbbell in 4 weeks. If you're doing front squat, you're going to do 175 this week, 195 here in 4 weeks. Got it? Let's go. And thinking about that from the, if they're nodding, if they're making eye contact, if they understand, they go to the rack, they communicate with their other rack partners. That's a good sign that right. They don't feel like they're completely overwhelmed, meaning I can go to rack, hey, Corey, what did you do last week? I did 175. Great. So I'm going to do 180 this week. You good with that? Yeah, me too. Let's get it. You know, that simple like discourse is a clear indicator that you're one, they understand what their assignment is, and every subordinate or every person that's complying with someone else's plan needs to be able to have some sort of connection, agreement, knowledge of how that plan should be executed on. And you can't just be the tour de force and saying, hey, I'm going to manage everyone's rack, because when you get to 10 racks, you're not going to be able to do that at a high level. So you need to have some sort of trust and autonomy at each individual station. But a large part of that is that they understand what they're supposed to do and why they're doing it. And when you're thinking about group dynamics and mesocycle organization, I think a very simple way to really understand and unpack someone's quality is, does that person on rack number 10 or the last rack in that room, the dumbest, least capable person, understand what they're supposed to do? And can they be successful? And then you can figure out, it's easier, it's like cooking. We can add nuance and complexity to our program. It's hard to subtract it. So if we think about that from the organization and structure, it should work out really well.
Yeah, thank you. Wow, that cleared a lot of stuff up for me. I hope our listeners brought their notebooks because this was good.
I told you, man. I had my synapsin beforehand and nicotine, and I'm ready to roll, man.
You know, I forgot my synapsin, but you know, we made it through.
Yeah, well, I mean, good thing is, well, you asked some really good questions. So maybe there's a positive half-life from whatever the last time you took it from.
Yeah, from weeks ago, last time I took it.
Yeah, exactly. So
get your synapsin. Yeah.
So good, man. So good. Just all right. Bowl a dose of synapsin every day.
So good.
All right, buddy.
All right, see you, Tim.